Born in the U.S., but denied a U.S. passport. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Hundreds, maybe thousands of Americans living along the U.S.-Mexico border are having their citizenship questioned right after they apply for a new passport.
A number of people who were denied their passports ended up being entered into deportation proceedings, which is incredibly frightening.
We'll hear why, for some people along the border, a U.S. birth certificate sometimes isn't enough to prove they're American. And later, confusion for people on the streets of Kabul when the Afghan Charlie Chaplin puts on a show.
They said, oh my God, Charlie Chaplin is in Afghanistan. But someone says, oh, Charlie Chaplin is dead. Who is this?
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Here's a big question to kick off the show with today. What is citizenship? How do we decide who is a citizen of a country and who is not? I'm thinking about this because it seems some basic principles of what makes a person a U.S. citizen are being questioned by our government in Washington. That's the sense you get when you read this headline today from the Washington Post. U.S. is denying passports to Americans along the border, throwing their citizenship into question. Kevin Seif reported this for The Post. You begin your story, Kevin, by talking about a guy you call Juan, born in the U.S. He's got a birth certificate, spent some time in the U.S. Army, then with the Border Patrol, and then as a prison guard. But the State Department won't give him a passport. Why not?
That's right. So, I mean, this is a guy who used his official U.S. passport to enlist in the military, to join the Border Patrol, to get a job as a Texas prison guard. He actually has had a passport before, so he was just renewing his passport. He sent all the documentation in that he would need, and instead of getting a passport back in the mail, he got a letter from the State Department that said it did not believe he was a U.S. citizen. It questioned whether he was actually born in the U.S., even though his birth certificate says exactly where he was born. The reason for this is a bit complicated, but basically, throughout the sort of 60s, 70s, and 80s, there were a number of midwives on the Texas-Mexico border who provided fraudulent birth certificates for a relatively small number of babies who were in fact born in Mexico. So in the 1990s, there were some trials, and some of the midwives pled guilty. And so the government has sort of had this old case in its back pocket for decades. They've known about this. And what happened beginning in the Obama administration is that people started applying for passports. And the government looked at their birth certificates and said, oh, well, you were delivered by a midwife who was accused of fraud 50 years ago. And so because of that, we don't believe they're a U.S. citizen. You have to provide a huge number of obscure documents like evidence of your mother's prenatal care, your baptismal certificate to convince us that you were, in fact, born in the U.S.
And how many people is this happening to? I mean, the application for a passport being denied.
So the State Department won't answer that question, which sort of leaves me to try to figure it out anecdotally. I can tell you that lawyers who are working on these cases are totally overwhelmed. I mean, some of them are getting a couple calls a day from people who are being denied. So we don't know the exact number. I think if we assume that everyone who was delivered by a midwife, or even the majority of people who were delivered by midwives on the border from, say, 1940 to 1995 are being denied or questioned, I mean, that number puts us in the hundreds of thousands, which is not to say that every one of those people has been denied, but a huge number of them have been. A huge number of them maybe haven't even applied for passports, so don't know that a denial awaits them. The one thing that is safe to say is that we're talking about a very, very large number of Americans who will be affected by this.
Well, I was going to ask you, I mean, if people can't prove they're Americans, is deportation potentially the direction this all goes in?
Yeah, I think that's one of the big concerns. I mean, I got this response from the State Department when I was reporting the story, where they said, yes, the State Department is alleging that these people are not U.S. citizens, but we, the State Department, cannot speak for other agencies, i.e. the State Department can't speak for the Department of Homeland Security, which is, to my mind, an incredibly bizarre thing to say, right? So you have one arm of the government that's saying that, yes, we don't think you're a citizen, but we're not necessarily going to deport you because that's up to ICE to decide. So basically, like, there are varying definitions of what citizenship means within the same federal government.
There's another fundamental thing here, too. The passport denial would seem to contravene the 14th Amendment. If you're born on U.S. soil, you're an American citizen. So how is Washington responding to that basic criticism?
But so that's again, like, raises the sort of larger philosophical question of, like, how do you prove you were born on U.S. soil? I'm an American citizen because I was born in South Florida. I have a U.S. birth certificate that was issued by the state of Florida that says I was born there. But Juan has an official birth certificate that said he was born in the state of Texas. So are we both citizens? Are neither of us citizens? I mean, we are citizens because we hold a bunch of documents in a file somewhere that we think connect us to, you know, to our citizenship, to our country. But what the government's saying now is that those documents are worthless. So the government isn't necessarily violating the 14th Amendment, because what it's saying is that they don't believe that these people were in fact born in the U.S., even though there's lots of evidence to prove that they were.
Kevin Seif with The Washington Post, thank you very much.
Sure, anytime.
So as we heard just now, even some basic fundamental things are being called into question when it comes to citizenship, like the 14th Amendment. It guarantees that if you're born on U.S. soil, you are a U.S. citizen. Let's remember the 14th also helped freed slaves become citizens after the Civil War. Many Americans are defending the 14th Amendment today as anti-immigrant groups attack it. Canada is also seeing threats to remove birthright citizenship, the idea that if you're born there, you're a citizen. This week, the Conservative Party in Canada filed a motion to get rid of birthright citizenship. Some Canadian conservatives are worried that in certain cases, foreigners come to Canada precisely to give birth and have instant Canadian offspring. Bashir Muhammad is a writer based in Edmonton. He was born stateless in Kenya to Somali refugee parents before moving to Canada and getting Canadian citizenship.
It's interesting because the motion itself, like birth tourism and all that stuff, they see it as a big issue. And when I wrote this thread, it got like a million impressions on Twitter. And the response was that I was fear-mongering and that statelessness won't happen and that all these things won't happen. They were saying that I should give them the benefit of the doubt, which is like a bit wild because, to give some context, the Conservative Party is the official opposition, which is the government in waiting. So in Canada, we have a whole bunch of parties, but they're the second largest. So in my mind, anytime a party that does something, we should take the resolution seriously.
Do you think you were fear-mongering?
No, because during the debate, someone brought up that this would create stateless people, but they still passed the motion anyways. We have an election next year. Immigration and diversity is becoming a huge political talking point here. And I think they're setting this up to be a big point of debate.
And from your own experience, is birth tourism something Canadians should worry about?
Well, I wasn't that aware of this being an issue until I was watching the debate. And this kept coming up. So I just looked into it. And Stats Canada, the numbers show that there were 300 births to foreign-born parents in 2016. Which I think represent like 0.08% of births in Canada in total. And then I went deeper and I found that a lot of them cite this one hospital in Richmond, BC, where I think 15% of births there were foreign-born. So it surprised me that with something that's not even verified, they want to use such a hard policy tool, which is changing citizenship versus addressing this in another way.
You may know we've also had similar talks of removing or changing our 14th Amendment here in the States. What do you think the consequences would be if both Canada and the U.S., two developed nations, neighbors with birthright citizenship, what if they were to remove that law?
By removing that, you're effectively taking away that tradition where people could come here and make a new life, and that by birth, everyone was equal. And in Canada, it's interesting. Anytime this debate has come up, here, it's always referred to undesirable groups, which historically have been non-white groups. So when Black people came into Alberta from the United States fleeing persecution, there was fears that they would outnumber white people. Chinese Canadians, when Chinese people came, they put in a head tax where they had to pay $500 in the 1900s just to be able to live here. But taking it away, I think, removes the principles that effectively built our countries and that make, you know, Americans equal and that make Canadians equal with each other.
You weren't born in Canada. You were born in Kenya to Somali parents. Why did this story catch your attention?
I guess I'm always hyper aware whenever stuff like this happens. The way the law is written is the same as the immigration law that was in Kenya in 1994. And I was born in the refugee camp and Kenya didn't give me citizenship and the Somali government didn't exist. So I was born stateless, but I got asylum in Canada in 97. And I saw this as the first step of a very hard shift in rhetoric when it comes to talking about immigration and diversity in Canada. Because if we can nip this now, then it prevents a much larger and messier debate in the future. And we've seen that kind of, I guess, in the States with how Trump gradually increased his rhetoric. And before he was talking about illegal immigration, but now he's talking about legal immigration. So my hope is just to prevent that from happening here.
Bashir Muhammad is a Somali-Canadian writer. He's been speaking with us from Edmonton. Bashir, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Manu Ginobili, shooting guard for the San Antonio Spurs, announced his retirement on Monday. That news has been met with celebration and sadness.
Oh my God! Ginobili! Ginobili!
Charles Barkley certainly isn't the only one chanting Ginobili. Fans and analysts are going down memory lane with pivotal moments in Ginobili's career, not to mention commemorative tacos. Hey, San Antonio, right? Ginobili clearly has left his mark on the NBA, but before his life as a Spur, he also had another international life. Shams Charania is a writer for Stadium and The Athletic. How does one begin to understand who Manu Ginobili is, Shams, and the legacy he's leaving behind?
I spoke with his agent, Herb Rudoy, in the hours after he retired, and he gave me an interesting story. His partner, Luciano Cappuccino, actually discovered Manu in Argentina in the mid-90s, where he played his formative years, and then brought him, Luciano did, to Italy. And from there, I mean, he goes to that 1999 NBA draft, very late second-round pick, and turns that into one of the more historic careers, four championships, all-star games, all-NBA teams.
Well, Ginobili fans obviously in San Antonio are shaken by the news, but so are his Argentine fans where his career began. What can you tell us about Ginobili in the early years? Like, how did he become a national hero and what were his early roots playing hoops?
You know, his formative years, like I said earlier, he played in Argentina where there wasn't much of a fanfare around him. And it really took people to discover him and find him and move him to Italy. Once he moved to Italy, he played with professional players, so that allowed more and more scouts to go view him. I think what really separated him was his flair. He brought the Euro step to the NBA, or really that move, and it's gone viral. You see James Harden doing it as a left-handed player.
Yeah, describe the Euro step. What exactly is the move?
Yeah, it's a quick 1-2 move going into the right or left direction, you know, without having to dribble the basketball and having a way to elude your defender. And I think he's the one that really brought that flair to the NBA and players have followed.
So the further Ginobili left the Argentine orbit and found success, the more Argentines kind of respected him.
Yeah, he was their best, you know, he was their best talent. They've had different players, Andres Nocioni, Fabrizio Oberto have come out of Argentina. And obviously they won the 2004 World, national championships. They won the Olympics in 2004, defeating Team USA, that vaunted Team USA team. So to be able to do that, I think cements Manu as a Hall of Famer even more. To be able to have that under his card, you know, not many people can say that they were part of the team that beat Team USA. So I think
In the semifinals
too. Right, exactly.
My producer, Brandy, who's something of a music head, she tells me that Manu Ginobili has a pop culture impact as well, in rap specifically. He's name-dropped in a bunch of songs like Drake's Jumpman. He's an icon for a lot of people, it sounds like.
I
hit that Ginobili with
my left hand, oh, like, woo! I think that there's a reason why his retirement was met with so much fanfare, because he was such a special part of a dynasty. You know, the Spurs were a dynastic team for the past pretty much 15 to 20 years, and he's been right in the middle of that.
What does the NBA lose with Manu Ginobili in retirement?
I think they're just going to miss a guy just like Kobe performed, just an all-out competitor and a guy that really put it all on the line and was a flat-out winner.
Shams Charania, a writer for Stadium and The Athletic, thanks very much for being with us and talking about Manu.
Yep, thank you guys. I appreciate it.
Coming up in a minute, how people on opposite sides of a border can be united through food. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. One thing that's always struck me about borders, the land on either side of them often looks the same. Also, the people on either side, they share cultures that transcend political borders. And so it makes sense that food connects those divided people. It's true even when war is involved. One woman has made it her mission to celebrate this common cross-border culture by developing and serving what she calls a bordered menu. Chavi Sachdev has her story from Mumbai.
Thank you all for joining us this evening. For those of you that
I'm in a swanky Mumbai apartment that Chef Ragini Kashyap has borrowed for the evening. She's hosting 18 people for one of her pop-up dinners. Dinners that center around conflict and cultures divided by war, but connected through food. Tonight's cuisine is from Punjab.
From undivided India, so across India and Pakistan.
In 1947, the province was divided between Pakistan and India, and even today, the two bordering countries are not exactly friends. At the time of the split, Muslims crossed over to Pakistan, Hindus went to India. And since that time, the two countries have fought four wars and have threatened each other with nuclear arms. Ragini, who is 30 years old, used to be a full-time education consultant, but she has always been interested in the history of food, why we eat what we eat, and why we have access to the foods we do.
We eat food based on the land around us. We draw borders on the lands around us. We then otherize the people who lived closest to us, even though they are the most similar to us. And so that was kind of the basic premise.
Tonight's menu is focused on the conflict cuisine of the India-Pakistan partition. Our first course is Amritsari fish, batter-fried fillets with a tangy crust from our side of the border in India, and from the other side, a chicken dish marinated in yogurt and spices called charga from Lahore, Pakistan. As we eat, Ragini explains that since the divide, each region is perceived to have its own distinct cuisine.
A lot of times, Punjabi food conjures up images of quite rich food and a fair amount of meat. In reality, more than 70% of Punjab is still agricultural, and people eat very, very simply. But what did happen is that we have this sort of somewhat artificial non-vegetarian characteristic of two people that are the same.
Ragini started her bordered menus last year and has given dinners in London, Vancouver, and now in Mumbai. Her cuisine is all over the map. She's done three different menus showcasing India's borders with Pakistan, Bangladesh, and China. And she's presented food about the conflict between Israel-Palestine, the US and Mexico, and the civil war factions in Sri Lanka. But tonight's dinner for her is personal. In 1947, her grandparents had little time to gather their belongings to escape across the new border to India.
Her great-grandmother packed all of her expensive saris and jewelry and so on into these two trunks and left them with a neighbor because they assumed that they would one day return.
Some of the dishes tonight are Ragini's family recipes. In fact, the pickled mango she is serving was actually made by her grandmother.
Oh, the achar is made by my nanny in Central.
The food is definitely the focus. But as we eat, many of the guests at the table have their own family stories. Hina Karya Thakkar is sitting with her husband at the far end. Her grandfather was almost killed trying to flee Pakistan.
He was held at gunpoint and he was like, either you leave everything and you leave the country because it's now not your country anymore, or we shoot you right here.
So this is your grandfather?
This is my grandfather. Who's still
tonight's diners are friends or friends of friends of the chef and others who just heard about the event and are curious about conflict cuisine. Arhan Bezbora is sitting directly across me. He and his wife traveled 3 hours from the city of Pune to get here.
I don't have a direct link to Punjab, but I grew up listening to a lot of stories that my grandparents often told me about those times in the 1940s. So I think there's something that's shared whether you're from Punjab or not.
Our soundtrack is music that predates the Punjab divide. There's Qawwali music from the Sufi Muslim traditions, now mostly associated with Pakistan, as well as a mix of folk music, which is heard more in India. Between courses, Chef Ragini shows us maps of where the countries were split, and she also shares black and white photos of her grandparents in the cities they left behind.
So, Punjab is the land of five rivers. That's the literal translation of the name. So you can see a lot of Punjab is actually landlocked within the rivers.
Ragini's goal with these dinners is not to simply showcase different types of cuisines. She believes food is a bridge between cultures that may be estranged from one another.
And I'm doing 6 courses. It's hardly exhaustive of, you know, all of the food from a region. So, and this really this idea of like we are all the same. And so one of my goals is to really highlight that.
Tonight's dinner is also personal for me. My grandparents escaped to India from what is now Pakistan too. In fact, my father was born in 1945 in what was then the Punjab province. And his passport still says, place of birth, Lahore, undivided India. Growing up, my family was always nostalgic about the Punjab left behind. They'd reminisce about their friends and the house they lived in, the colleges they'd attended, the bazaars they'd never visit again. With bordered cuisine on my mind, I wanted to find out more. So I met my parents for lunch. At her house in New Delhi, my mother served the food I grew up on, traditional Punjabi food. Lunch was potatoes and peas in a brown gravy with stir-fried jackfruit and a common flatbread called chapati. The menu is vegetarian, which is pretty typical in most Indian families. When I dined with my Pakistani friends, their vegetables and lentil dishes are mixed with meat. But my mother says before 1947, her parents ate a shared cuisine. There was not only more mutton and game like rabbit, but also desserts like sevaiyan, a creamy pudding made with vermicelli noodles now considered Pakistani. Back then, these dishes were just considered Punjabi. My great-grandmother would cook all of them, my grandmother less so, but my mother never inherited these recipes, which were lost as the family moved further from their roots.
They didn't have recipes written, and they just made it instinctively, that's how they cook.
But it seems the borders may be a little more porous these days. Just last year, we began to see a fresh offering from across enemy lines. Our dessert fruit, mango.
Ah, mango. You want to try these Pakistani mangoes? This is the Pakistani one.
Recently, my mother managed to buy Pakistani mangoes in her local market. And she says they're better than the ones grown here on the India side of the border. As I leave lunch with my parents, 72 years after the India-Pakistan partition, I realize the food I grew up on was shaped deeply by conflict. And then I understand how Chef Ragini uses food to bridge cultures that have been separated by borders for decades. For The World, Chavi Sachdev, Mumbai.
Chavi shared 2 bordered recipes from that night in Mumbai with Chef Ragini. You can find those dishes at PRI.org. I'm already looking at the dessert course. Chavi's grandma's recipe. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, a toddler died after getting really sick inside an immigration detention facility. Her mom was there but couldn't do anything.
Yasmin couldn't take Marie home in this situation. She had to watch her suffer for 20 days and wasn't able to get her the help she thinks she needed.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. For months on the show, we've been following lots of stories about families detained at the border and the risks to children. Recently, we've been tracking a story about one little girl who died right after leaving an ICE detention center. But the details were murky. Reporter Taylor Dolvin at Vice News has been looking into this story from the start and published the results this week. Thanks for being with us, Taylor. Tell us, first of all, what happened to 18-month-old Marie Juarez.
So my colleague Kathleen and I first connected with Marie's mother, Yasmin, back in June. She and Marie came from Guatemala fleeing violence in late February and arrived in Texas on March 1st. They were detained for a few days in a border patrol facility and were then transferred to ICE's Dili Family Detention Center, where they stayed for 20 days. There, Marie became really sick with a fever, vomiting, diarrhea, cough, congestion. She briefly recovered, but then got worse again, and they were released on March 25th. She died at a hospital in Philadelphia in May.
So Marie died of pneumonitis. What is that?
Viral pneumonitis is a viral infection. She had several viruses during her illness. She originally was diagnosed with bronchiolitis, which is a common cold virus for kids. She also had the adenovirus, which is another one of those. But her condition really deteriorated after she left Dili, and she wasn't able to recover.
Now, when this story first got out on social media, it was reported that Maria died in the ICE facility while in detention. ICE put out a statement denying that. What did you find out about the timing and location of her death?
Maria did not die at the Dili Detention Center. She died 6 weeks and 4 days later at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. But doctors that we interviewed raised concerns about conditions at Dili that they may have impacted Marie's ability to recover, specifically the stress of being detained and also the crowded conditions. If a child contracts a viral infection in confinement, whether it's daycare or detention, that's a common situation. Viral infections spread more easily in confinement. The difference here is that if a kid contracts a viral infection in daycare, their mother can take them home and nurse them back to health. Yasmin couldn't take Marie home in this situation. She had to watch her suffer for 20 days before ultimately being released, and wasn't able to get her the help she thinks she needed.
So I have two questions. The first one is, did she get the proper medical care for her condition in the detention facility? You looked at her medical records.
Yep. So we analyzed her medical records both from her time in ICE and at the three hospitals she was treated with after, two in New Jersey and one in Philadelphia. And pediatricians who reviewed her condition as reflected in her medical records from ICE told us that there are no red flags about the treatment she received. But they all did say that the conditions in Dili likely caused her to contract the virus and made it harder for her to recover.
There were a lot of media reports focused on the McAllen, Texas facility. Tell us a little bit more about the Dili facility. Like, how long has it been around, and is this the main place they're keeping kids?
The Dili facility was constructed in 2014 to hold families, undocumented immigrant families, who come to the U.S. seeking asylum. But advocates, both medical advocates and immigration advocates, have long raised concerns about conditions at Dili. Our reporting cites several reports from DHS and ICE themselves where independent investigators have found concerning medical conditions for kids there.
Yeah, and those conditions, I mean, describe some of them.
Yasmin told us that she and Marie shared a bed in a room with five other mothers and their children. She said when she took Marie to get medical treatment, they had to wait in line in an over-air-conditioned gym with hundreds of other sick kids. She also said they had to wait in line for hours every time Marie needed medicine and weren't able to have Tylenol or things to treat a fever in their cell. At one point, Yasmin became so desperate about Marie's condition that she asked the officials if she could return to Guatemala just so that she could take Marie to a hospital.
Wow.
Things were really dire.
So now Marie's mom, Yasmin, is suing ICE. What does her lawsuit allege?
It's not an official lawsuit yet. Lawyers for Yasmin sent a notice of legal action to the city of Eloy, Arizona this week. In a bizarre contracting system, ICE pays Eloy to pay the private prison company CoreCivic to run the Dili Detention Center in Texas. They're asking for $40 million from the city of Eloy in a wrongful death claim.
Has ICE responded?
ICE has not responded to that action or to us about questions about Marie's treatment and conditions for her and other kids at Dili. They've said that they do their best to care for every kid who comes through Dili.
I mean, it is hard to know how and when and where anybody gets sick. Sometimes it's obvious, but not so in this case. Was this a hard story, a complex story to report because of that?
Yeah, it was a really hard story. When we looked at the timeline originally, we really thought that the doctors must have done something egregiously wrong. Our reporting showed otherwise, that Marie did receive the proper treatment. But it showed something different, which is that detaining kids, confinement in itself, can create a situation where kids are more likely to get sick and also less likely to be able to recover from those sicknesses. You know, viral infections, kids rebound from those infections all the time. We've all had viral infections and we all had them as children. So it begs the question, what really made it harder for her to recover here?
Reporter for Vice News, Taylor Dalvin, who co-reported with her colleague Kathleen Calderwood the story about the death of toddler Marie Juarez. Thank you very much, Taylor.
Thank you.
The phrase war games always seemed like an oxymoron, especially when there can be casualties. Consider what's about to happen next month. Russia's getting ready for massive war games. If they're as big as the Russians claim, this will be one of the biggest military exercises in history, as in the history of the world. And here's something else. China is sending troops to take part as well. The venue for the war games will be Siberia, not too far from Russia's border with China. Seems like these two countries haven't been this chummy since Lyndon Johnson was president. To help me get my head around all of this, our own history guy, Chris Wolf, joins me in the studio. So just how big are these war games, Chris?
It's big. We're talking 300,000 personnel, 36,000 armored vehicles, and over 1,000 aircraft.
Wow, that's like double D-Day, right?
Yeah, it may just seem like numbers to you, but you've got to compare it. This is the equivalent of the population of Iceland or Barbados or St. Louis or Pittsburgh. This is how many people are involved. The peak strength for the U.S. in Iraq in 2008 was about 150,000 or so. So it's about double that. And again, about double the size of the U.S. and combined allied forces on D-Day. You know, this is a memorable national undertaking. The memories and stories that these people will be creating will be carried for life. As I can testify a little bit, as a young man, I was on Operation Lionheart back in 1984, which is still the biggest British war game since World War II.
Right. You were enlisted. What is it like to be on one of these exercises?
Well, you can't see the scale of it. You can just see the guys around you, but you can feel that something is different to a regular exercise simply because you're rolling over like an entire country. In our case, Germany, like every field and village is in play. And that's because there isn't a training ground big enough to accommodate this number of people. In fact, I remember defending some old lady's front yard, and in between attacks, she would bring us tea. So just to give you a sense of how involved you are and out there, then there's just the sheer novelty of the sights and sounds, and you're hungry and tired, and you start to think, is this real or not? What's going on? And, you know, and there's also a level of risk there as well.
Yeah, were there any fatalities on this war games that you were involved in?
Yeah, on this scale, it's pretty hard to avoid accidents, and sadly, they can be fatal sometimes. There are, I believe, three fatal casualties on Operation Lionheart, including one near where, on the ground where I was deployed a few days later, where a tank had gone over someone, unfortunately.
So British Operation Lionheart, that was 1984. Surely there have been bigger exercises than this Russian one that's coming up during the Cold War.
No, I've done as much research as I can. I can't find anything that's even comparable. America's biggest exercise was Reforger 1988 in Western Europe. But really, there haven't been even this many U.S. troops in one place since the first Gulf War back in 1991.
So why now? Why is Russia putting on this massive show of force?
Well, ostensibly, like any exercise, it's to test readiness and new weapon systems. There's a saying, the more you sweat in peace, the less you bleed in combat. But as one senator in Moscow has said, it's also something that they hope will cool hotheads in their rivals, particularly the U.S. In some circles in Russia, they feel under pressure from the U.S. and they need to show their readiness.
And does it tell us anything about the modern Russian military?
Yeah, I think when I've been to conferences, people have been talking about the Russian military. They say, you know, they've been showing good capacity for hybrid warfare. In fact, they kind of invented the modern concept when they took over Crimea and when they kind of invaded Ukraine. They've also shown that they're good at like support operations, as they're showing in Syria. But what this is showing is something completely different, which is a capacity to wage good old style conventional armored warfare on a grand scale.
So should we be worried about the show of force from Russia?
Well, it depends who you talk to. There are some defense types who say, you know, Europe and the U.S. are kind of asleep at the wheel as Russia is rearming. But others disagree. You know, people are reminding us that Russia has the GDP equivalent of, say, Spain or Australia and has few real allies. You know, its GDP is one-tenth that of China, for example. And also, you know, on their own, Russia could not realistically take on even Japan at air and sea. The Japanese would outgun them in those vital areas.
Should we be worried about the fact that China is playing a role in these war games?
Well, it's a signal for sure. That's what a lot of the experts are saying, that both Beijing and Moscow can cooperate if they choose to and are practicing cooperating if, you know, necessary. However, they're a long way from being allies. They have a lot of competing interests themselves. Chinese analysts that I've been reading are saying it's showing the potential for cooperation. China wants to pursue its own non-aligned foreign policy. And we should also note that the Chinese are not going to be able to roll over the countryside. They will be confined to a military training ground. The Russians may be happy to have them take part, but they don't want them, you know, roaming at will.
The World's Chris Wolf, thanks very much for this.
You're welcome, Marco.
This week, we've been looking back at the life of the late Senator John McCain. Today, we want to revisit Russian President Vladimir Putin's opinion of McCain. It was pretty clear we know how the senator felt about the former KGB agent.
Putin is a killer, and he's a killer. And he might very well be the next target. Vladimir knew that there was no moral equivalence between the United States and Putin's Russia. I repeat, there is no moral equivalent between that butcher and thug and KGB colonel and the United States of America.
That's McCain on the Senate floor last year. He was speaking out against the Kremlin's treatment of Russian dissidents like Vladimir Kara-Murza, who had just been poisoned for a second time. More about him in a minute. In Russia, though, what did Putin think of McCain?
Господин Маккейн, как известно, попал в плен во Вьетнаме и просидел не просто в тюрьме, а в яму его посадили. Он сидел там несколько лет.
That's Putin from a 2011 interview with Russian state media. He was talking about John McCain's time in Vietnam. After McCain crashed outside Hanoi in his Navy jet and ended up a POW for 5 years, of course, Putin said, anybody would go crazy after that. A fairly harsh comment. More recently, pro-Kremlin news outlets have stuck with that theme. They weren't afraid to call McCain an enemy of Russia. But here's something kind of curious. Vladimir Putin's opinion of Senator McCain might actually have softened over the years. Here's Putin again, this time in an interview with Showtime last year.
На самом деле он для меня даже немножко симпатичен. Да-да-да, я не шучу сейчас. Он симпатичен мне своим патриотизмом.
Actually, I kind of like him, Putin said. The interviewer started laughing. No, seriously, Putin came back. I like McCain's patriotism. Then the Russian president elaborated.
Но, вы знаете, вот в Древнем Риме был известный Марк Порций.
Putin went on to compare McCain to Marcus Porcius Cato of ancient Rome, who was the first to document history in Latin. This is someone who's stuck in the old world, Putin said, unwilling to recognize how fast the world is changing around him. Almost sounds like Putin had been keeping tabs on the Arizona senator all these years. Obsessed, maybe. Not so surprising, perhaps. After all, McCain helped pass the Magnitsky Act in 2012, aimed at punishing Russian officials responsible for the death of Sergei Magnitsky in a Moscow jail. Magnitsky, the anti-corruption tax accountant Putin threw in jail. And let's not forget that John McCain was an outspoken supporter of Georgia and Ukraine in their wars with Russia. At his own funeral this weekend, McCain will take one final shot at Vladimir Putin. As we reported on the show yesterday, one of McCain's pallbearers will be the previously mentioned Vladimir Kara-Murza. He's the Russian opposition politician and Putin critic who was poisoned twice but survived. Kara-Murza told Politico that being a pallbearer for McCain would be the most heartbreaking honor that anyone could think of. To wrap things up today, we want to bring you a story about a certain clumsy man with a distinctive mustache, a bowler hat, and a cane. You know the one, Charlie Chaplin, the comedic legend who changed the world of cinema and acting forever. He's loved around the globe and is making a comeback in an unlikely place, a place marked by decades of war. The World's Shirin Jafari has a story of Afghanistan's own Charlie Chaplin.
In the early 1990s, when the Taliban came to power, Karim Asir's parents fled Afghanistan for Iran. Iranians loved Charlie Chaplin. His black-and-white silent films were a constant presence on state TV. Soon, Asir, too, became obsessed. There's this scene from the 1921 film The Kid that Asir remembers vividly.
It was the famous scenes of Charlie Chaplin that one guy threw a stone on the glasses, and then Charlie Chaplin was the glass seller.
Chaplin plays a window repairman who secretly cuts a deal with his adopted son and sidekick. The moment Chaplin repairs the broken window, the kid hurls a stone at it, smashing it into pieces. So the building owner hires Chaplin to fix it again. Asir got hooked on these old movies. Then, when he was 12, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan and defeated the Taliban. Asir's parents thought it was safe to move back home. And Asir's passion for Chaplin followed him to Afghanistan. To his parents' dismay, he decided to study theater, not medicine or law.
I said to my father and to my mother that I can't be a doctor, but I have this skill that I can be an artist.
Asir went to Kabul University and became an actor. He was really good at pantomime. And one day during a rehearsal, he performed that scene from the film The Kid, the one where Charlie Chaplin is a window repairman. And then it dawned on him.
My face and my body was the same of Charlie Chaplin. And I said, okay, let's try it, that I can be Charlie Chaplin or no.
He began to make YouTube videos of himself as Chaplin. He donned the toothbrush mustache, black bowler hat, baggy pants, oversized shoes, and that distinctive black eyeliner. Asir's videos took off.
And then it was really fantastic. I'm famous in Afghanistan by Afghani Charlie Chaplin.
Today, Asir's Chaplin is popular among Afghans. He's often on local TV shows, and many of his videos get thousands of views from around the world. His fans in Kabul line up to take selfies with him after his live street shows. Sometimes, Asir says, when he performs his Chaplin, people think he's the real deal.
At first, they didn't know that this is an Afghan. They said, oh my God, Charlie Chaplin is in Afghanistan. But someone says, oh, Charlie Chaplin is dead. Who is this? I said, okay, I think this guy is from Afghanistan.
So why does this little character with a distinct mustache and clumsy walk resonate in a country marred by years of war and displacement?
It's because he could speak to people throughout the world with his pantomime.
Lisa Steinhaven is a professor at Ohio University in Zanesville. She says Chaplin strikes a chord throughout the world, even today. His silence, she says, is a universal language that allows people to laugh.
There was no words involved. There was no language. This is why he didn't want to go to dialogue film, is because he didn't want to put an English language on it.
Steinhaven says Chaplin's popularity abroad is part of his legacy. When he was alive, he cultivated fans all over the globe.
He had fans in Asia, he had fans in Russia, he had fans all over the world. I think he went to Bali in 1932 and he found that his films had been seen there, and Bali was relatively untouched at that time.
But for Asir, Charlie Chaplin is about a lot more than just entertaining. He uses this character to try to make needed changes in his war-torn country.
This is one of my goals, that show the social problems with the Afghani Charlie Chaplin, because the face is very famous for the people and they accept it very soon.
For example, Asir feels very strongly about the environment, and it bothers him that he sees people in Kabul throw garbage out of the window on the streets. So at a recent performance at an orphanage in Kabul, he wanted to make a point. His audience was about 24 boys, but this was not a silent performance. There were actors here too. And they all stood in front of this large painting. It depicts the Kabul city scene, and there are plastic bags sticking out of the canvas. The kids giggle as Asir's Chaplin waddles across the stage. One of the actors delivers the message. Keeping our streets clean shouldn't be the job of the trash collectors only. We all have to do our part. As Asir ponders his future as Afghanistan's Charlie Chaplin, he doesn't take for granted that every day here there are bombings and random violence. And that means not everybody finds humor in what he's doing.
They said, we don't have water, we don't have a good place for life, but you're coming in here and you're trying to make us funny. I said, okay, we have these problems, but we also need to be happy. So maybe this will be a gift from us to those people that they're always thinking about the war, they're always thinking about the bad situation.
Asir is reminded of that bad situation every day. He plans to bring his chaplain to other parts of the country, but it's too dangerous. Just recently, the Taliban had a violent takeover of Ghazni, a city about 100 miles outside of Kabul. But the bloodshed and uncertainty here are not going to stop Asir. He says people in his country desperately need something to smile about.
Most of the people like that, and after the performance, they come to me and telling me, this is really good for me, this is really interesting for me, and I'm proud of myself.
After all, if there's a lesson he's learned from his idol, it's this. When life hits you hard, you pick up your hat, dust yourself off, shrug, and move on. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafar. But Charlie was a man, and that man could turn serious into delirious. He had a myriad of ways to paint this mountain.
Every woman in the house went, oh, if they wanted to act, they better act on cue. So, leaving you with J5 featuring Charlie Chaplin from his classic Modern Times, a bit of vaudeville, some hip hop. These are modern times. Check out photos and videos of Afghanistan's Charlie Chaplin at PRI.org. And that is a wrap for us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you all back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.